the doctors at the local hospital said. His voice trailed off in embarrassment. You should have examined her yourself, but, I added, feeling the need to wield a carrot after the stick, you're here to learn. I turned to the registrars, who were enjoying the ritual of teaching by teasing of the new SHO. Who was on last night? David, one of the registrars nearing the end of his 6 years' training, called out that he had been on call for emergencies. She had a right hemiplegia, he said. Her neck was a bit stiff too. What are the other possible signs on examination if she'd had a subarachnoid hemorrhage? They can have subhyaloid hemorrhage in the eyes. Did she? I didn't look. The ward ophthalmoscope was lost ages ago. The woman's brain scan flashed up in front of us. Bloody hell, I said as I looked at it. Why on earth did you accept her? It's a massive bleed into the dominant hemisphere. She's 72, she's in coma. We're never going to treat her, are we? Well, Mr. Marsh, David replied, a little apologetically, the referring hospital said she was 62. She'd been a university lecturer. Pretty smart, the daughter said. Well, she's not going to be smart any longer, my colleague sitting next to me said. Anyway, David said, we had some empty beds, and the bed managers were trying to put some non-neuro patients in them. I asked if there had been any other admissions. The oncologists referred a woman with melanoma, Tim, one of the other registrars, said, walking to the front of the room to take over from the SHO. He put a brain scan up on the wall in front of us. The scan showed two large and ragged tumours in the brain, which were clearly inoperable. Multiple brain tumours are almost always secondary tumours, known as metastases, from cancers that have started elsewhere, such as cancers of the breast or lung, or, as in this case, of the skin. Their development signifies the beginning of the end, although in some cases treatment can prolong life by a year or so. The referral letter says she drinks 140 units of alcohol a week, Tim told us. I saw one of the SHOs in the front row doing some rapid mental arithmetic. That's two bottles of vodka a day, she said in slight amazement. She had a cerebral met removed at another hospital 18 months ago, Tim said. And radiotherapy afterwards. The oncologists wanted biopsied. I asked him what he had told them. I said they were inoperable and a biopsy was unnecessary. They're obviously melanoma mets. They might as well make the diagnosis post-mortem. I love your positive attitude, my colleague sitting next to me said. So, what's the message back to the oncologists? Keep on drinking, somebody shouted happily from the back of the room. With no more cases to discuss, we filed out of the viewing room to start the day's work. I stopped at my office to collect my dictation machine. Don't forget to remove your tie, Gail shouted at me through the door to her office. The new chief executive for the trust, the seventh since I had become a consultant, was especially keen on the 22-page trust dress code, and my colleagues and I had recently been threatened with disciplinary action for wearing ties and wristwatches. There is no evidence that consultants wearing ties and wristwatches contributes to hospital infections. But the chief executive viewed the matter so seriously that he had taken to dressing as a nurse and following us on our ward rounds, refusing to talk to us and instead making copious notes. He did, however, wear his chief executive badge, I suppose just in case somebody asked him to empty a bedpan. And your watch, Gail added with a laugh as I stomped off to see my outpatients. The outpatients wait in a large and windowless room on the ground floor. There are many patients sitting in obedient silence in rows, as there are many clinics going on all at once in the new centralized outpatient department. The place has all the charm of an unemployment benefits office, although with the added detail of a magazine rack holding leaflets on how to live with Parkinson's disease, prostatism, irritable bowel syndrome, myasthenia gravis, colostomy bags, and other unpleasant conditions. There are two large abstract paintings, one purple, one lime green, which had been hung on the walls by the hospital arts officer, an enthusiastic woman in black leather trousers, on the occasion of a visit by one of the royals for the official opening of the new building a few years ago. I made my way past the waiting patients who watched me as I walked to the consulting room. My first sight on entering the consultation room was a Babel-like tower of multicoloured folders containing the patient's notes, a pile rarely less than 2 feet high, a tower of sheets of paper bursting out of dog-eared files in which the recent relevant results have rarely been filed, and if they have been filed in such a way that it is usually very difficult to find them. I can learn, usually in entirely random order, about my patient's birth history, and perhaps their gynecological, dermatological, or cardiological conditions, but rarely find information such as when I had operated on the patient, or the analysis of the tumour I removed. I have learnt that it is usually much quicker to ask the patient instead. The Trust has to devote ever-increasing numbers of staff and resources to the constant tracking, searching, and transporting of medical notes. The greater part of the notes, I should explain, consist of nursing charts recording the patient's passing of bodily fluids on previous admissions and are no longer of any interest or importance. There must be many tons of such notes being carried around NHS hospitals every day in a strange archival ritual which brings dung beetles to mind, devoted to the history of patients' excretions. My outpatient clinic is an odd combination of the trivial and the deadly serious. It is here that I see patients weeks or months after I have operated on them, new referrals or long-term follow-ups. They are wearing their own clothes, and I meet them as equals. They are not yet inpatients, who have to submit to the depersonalizing rituals of being admitted to the hospital, to be tagged like captive birds or criminals, and to be put into bed like children in hospital gowns. I refuse to have anybody else in the room. No students, no junior doctors or nurses, only the patients and their families. Many of the patients have slowly growing brain tumours, too deep in the brain to operate upon, and yet not growing fast enough to justify the palliative cancer treatment of radiotherapy or chemotherapy. They come to see me once a year for a follow-up scan to see if their tumour has changed or not. I know that they will be sitting outside the consultation room in the dark and dreary waiting area, sick with anxiety, waiting to hear my verdict. Sometimes I can reassure them that nothing has changed. Sometimes the scan shows that the tumour has grown. They are being stalked by death, and I am trying to hide, or at least disguise, the dark figure that is slowly approaching them. I have to choose my words very carefully. Since neurosurgery deals with diseases of the spine as well as of the brain, part of any neurosurgical outpatient clinic is spent talking to patients with back problems, only a few of whom need surgery. With one patient with a brain tumour, I will be trying to explain that his or her life is probably coming to an end, or that they require terrifying surgery to their brain. Whereas with the next, I will be telling them, struggling to appear sympathetic and uncritical, that their backache is perhaps not as terrible a problem as they feel it to be, and that life can perhaps be worth living despite it. Some of the conversations I have in the clinic are joyful, and some absurd, and others can be heartbreaking. They are never boring. Having looked at the pile of notes with a feeling of slight despair, I sat down and turned on the computer. I returned to the reception desk to look at the list of patients for the clinic and find out who had arrived. All I could see were several blank sheets of paper. I